You can probably hear I'm not in a studio. The programme this week comes from the very middle of Maribor Park, and I'm sitting with a teacher who is a trainer. He actually lives right now in Switzerland. The name is Alec Templeton. Welcome to the programme.
Nice to be here.
Alec, I think, first of all, I've got to say why. What do you bring in your training exercise and who for here in Slovenia?
Well, basically, it is for Waldorf teachers. There's four Waldorf schools in Slovenia, and I've been to two of them now. Ljubljana I was once, and Maribor three times. And I think what they get me for is that I give them ideas about how to go about their work, and at the same time give them a sort of courage and a sort of self-confidence by saying, you mustn't take this job too seriously, and you can have a low, laid-back sort of attitude towards it, and the kids appreciate that, and they're much quieter, and they don't cause discipline problems.
Interesting. Let me just find out a bit more about the fact you speak with a perfectly English accent, but you live in Switzerland. Please explain.
Well, I think I must have picked up my accent during the aged 11 to 18 when I was in England. And I was in a public school in London. And that's the sort of English that we heard all the time from most of the teachers and quite a few of the mates, but most of them actually tried to not speak like that. And we tried Cockney and all sorts of things as well. So I can do Cockney too.
But I guess you spend most of your time not speaking English then when you're in Switzerland.
Well, not quite so, because I'm a teacher of English, after all, and I did teach English all the time, and that's the sort of English I have now mainly developed as the content of my lessons. I want to give them a good model, and I thought this English was good enough for that.
But are you French-speaking as well?
Yes, I am, but not fluently. I mean, je sais parler français, si vous voulez.
C'est très bien.
Ouais. En effet, j'habite hors de la Suisse, j'habite en France. 3 kilometers à l'autre côté de la frontière.
That is 30 kilometers to the frontier?
3 kilometers.
Oh, trois, you said. Ah, yeah. You see? My French isn't perfect. I don't exercise my French, that's the problem.
And that reminds me of my French oral exam at school in England. I wasn't very good at French, and they asked in the oral exam, qu'est-ce que tu vas faire quand tu as faim? And I thought that would mean, what am I going to do when we've finished? Hoping that it would be. And then what happened was, this happened to be before lunch, and I said, je vais manger. And that was the right answer, because quand tu as faim means, what do you do when you're hungry?
Aha, uh-huh, right. You were lucky.
I was lucky. It took me months to find out what I actually did wrong.
Excellent. We're a music show as well, and you've thrown together some pieces of music that you like for various reasons. Do you want to pick one of them to start with?
Well, yes, okay, let's take Count Basie. Actually, it's one of the very rare occasions I did go to a live jazz concert, and it was in a place in Basel, which used to be quite famous in all of Europe, especially amongst jazz musicians, and it was called Atlantis.
What to do with the sea was that?
I don't really know, because we're as far away from the sea as we can possibly
exactly.
get. That was the worst thing about being in Switzerland, actually, being so far away from the sea. Atlantis was well known, and I got invited there. And we went, and it was this Count Basie jazz group, sort of a year or 10 after Count Basie himself had died. But the others were still all there, and that was absolutely amazing. A lovely evening.
There is something special about live music, no matter what, actually, isn't there? I mean, I'm perfectly happy being asked to go to a live concert of anything.
Yes, I agree. I think the live music is definitely to be preferred over any kind of recorded music, yes.
But if you fall in love with some of the artists you see, occasionally you like to hear them at other times. So
well,
I think recorded music has a value.
Of course it does, yes. I mean, I still turn on Yehudi Menuhin sometimes, playing the things that I can't play properly, just to listen to. That's nice.
Which means you play musical instruments, what?
Yeah, I used to play the violin, or I still do actually, but I found out that if I changed to the viola, then I'd be much more in demand. And then I found that there were quartets looking for violas. They never need violinists, there are too many of those. But the viola has a much better chance of getting into a quartet. And the music isn't half as difficult to play.
Have you been in Slovenia long enough to go to concerts here?
No, I haven't.
Then I insist that next time you're here, you have at least one extra day and we will find a great concert, because Slovenia is packed with good musical entertainment and great expertise.
Well, that's a wonderful idea. I'd like to do that. I know there's a quartet on tonight, which I'm not going to because...
Because I'm in the way.
Well, no, because I thought this was nice too.
Very kind of you. We've already talked our way to another piece of music. Time flies very quickly when you're having an interesting conversation. Where should we go next? Should we move into the world of classical music?
Yeah, okay, let's go into Haydn, Opus 74, Part 2. That's one I've played. That is a manageable piece of music for me.
Okay.
Where you can really start thinking about being musical, you know, forgetting the notes, forgetting the techniques, forgetting the positions that you have to use. Mm. And you can really start enjoying playing it. Because a lot of other stuff is just sort of on the limit of what I can do technically.
Right.
Yeah.
The guest in the show today, visiting the Waldorf School here in Maribor, a teacher and trainer, Alec Templeton. Let's talk a little bit about early days, because we discovered that you speak English very well, but you live currently in Switzerland. Where were you born? What were your parents, your early influences?
All right, well, actually, I was a product of the Second World War. A British soldier of Scottish descent, finding a Dutch girl, liberating Holland. So that's why we were only in England for a year. I was born in London, Ealing, in fact.
And the, fine place.
Yes. I think the maternity ward was actually in Southall.
Okay.
And where we lived, it was close to a loony bin. And funnily enough, my mother told me about it because she would take me for walks in the pram and these loonies would accompany her on the other side of the wall. And many, many years later in Stuttgart in Germany, I met this guy who said that in 1948, which was the year that I was born, he worked in that particular loony bin as a nurse.
So he may have been one of the people who saw you walking past.
That is what I speculated on as well.
He probably wouldn't recognise you then.
No.
Not from that moment. School, where did you really learn to grow up and be a useful adult?
Well, I think primary school has a much, much bigger influence on one than one thinks. I was in Holland for the primary school time.
So does that mean you did it in Dutch?
That's right. Uh-huh. And my mother's tongue, I mean, normally in many languages you call it your mother language, but is your native language. And in my case, it was literally my mother's language was Dutch. Mm. So we spoke Dutch at home to her, and I spoke English to my dad. It was only nice. Much later, actually, when I introduced my wife to be to my dad, and my wife is also Dutch, that my dad started talking Dutch for the first time I'd ever heard him.
Really?
And I was absolutely amazed that he spoke Dutch.
That's charming, because he did it because of your wife.
Yes. Mm. But he must have spoken Dutch quite well, because you know he had a position as in a textile company in the east of Holland. That was actually a family-owned thing. That's why he got the job, actually, because he was working for Robson and Morrows, which was a sort of consultant firm in London. But he worked there before the war, and then after the war, he tried to get back into it with little success. And that's why my grandfather from Holland invited him to come into the company. And he stuck that for 10 years, and then England had found its feet again, and then we went back to the UK.
At this point, I'll ask you another piece of music.
Well, let's go to the Brave New World then. In England was for me a brave new world somehow. I mean, I really enjoyed being in Holland, but we lived in the countryside. I mean, the next door house was a farm with pigs, and, you know, they got slaughtered once a year, and we'd always hear the squealing and run out to go and watch. And when I came to England, it was inner city kind of stuff, Watford. And that was totally a different kind of life, and I quite enjoyed that.
Was that experience accepted, or did you...
No, I just accepted that. That's part of life. Although I didn't actually eat very much meat ever, but... No, it didn't put me off meat or anything like that. I thought it was quite funny, actually, the way they made sausages. And I realised what went into sausages.
Yeah.
And that
not
didn't
just
put
pork
me off.
Too.
But no, exactly. But it was a formative time, this time in Holland, especially my love of nature and love of birds. I'm a sort of bird watcher. We had a lot of birds very close and, you know, photographed them. We looked for the eggs. Especially lapwings eggs. They're very good to eat, those.
Are you supposed to take eggs?
Not anymore, but in those days, people didn't worry. the Queen of Holland always got the first ones that were found every year, and it was always sort of April the 8th or something like that. But I know that in the year 90 probably, she said, well, I'm sorry, but she can't accept that anymore, and, you know, attitudes changed.
The next part of your education?
Yeah, so when I was 5, we went to England. That was rather a dramatic thing, to tell you the truth, because I thought we were going on holiday. My mum thought we were going on a holiday. But when we were there, she was informed that we would not be allowed to leave England again. It was a sort of trap in a way, because she'd always been against going back to England. We were made wards of court, and apparently we were one of the latest cases under a law which was afterwards rescinded, under which this was possible. So we were not allowed to go back, and we didn't have a passport, so we couldn't actually run away. My mum was free to go where she wanted. But actually, after that, I must say, after looking back on it, it's amazing that she stayed in the family. But marriage must have irretrievably broken down. I don't know about that. Never heard the details or anything like that. But I really owe it to my mum that she was a sort of mainstay of my existence.
She had the strength to make it work on your behalf.
That's right. Yeah. And that really convinced me about the quality of anthroposophy, because she was an anthroposophist, and she always said that that was what gave her the strength to do it. And that for me was something, you know, beyond theory and reading and lectures and stuff. It was a sort of showing a moral quality of that. We were packed off to a Steiner school just for 3 months, looking for a place, a proper school, and that was a prep school. I was too young to go to public school then, and my dad found one in Northants.
Whereabouts?
Just north of Banbury. Banbury's Oxfordshire, but if you go up the road...
I was brought up there.
Yeah, Middleton Cheney was the church that we always went to, and the school was called Overthorpe Hall. But we had to walk across the fields and then go to Warkworth Church.
The next piece of music.
Okay, well, let's take Dvorak Opus 100, Sonata.
Because you can play this too?
No, that's something I couldn't play. That was beyond me, and I enjoyed listening to it for that reason.
Alec, we've got to the point where you've got to primary school. What was next in terms of your school? You're actually at a Waldorf school.
Yep.
That's very early for a Waldorf school too. There were not that many in the UK at this point.
No, that's right. So I was there for 3 months only in a class 6, the sixth year. There I experienced getting a love letter from a girl for the first time.
Wonderful.
And unfortunately, I rejected her, and I have regretted it ever since, because actually she's quite nice. But it was too early for me. I was only 12. My best friend...
You can't regret a decision made at 12, Alec.
Well, you can't, I did. And my best friend there, actually a chap called Daniel Jones, who later became the Professor Daniel Jones. Yeah, I think he spent most of his time at Cardiff University. He copyrighted and invented and designed lean technology. He was very advanced, and he had this girlfriend, and he really did hit it off with her. And I was always a bit jealous of that. So that was very formative. But anyway, after 3 months, unfortunately, I mean, I didn't think so at the time, but afterwards I thought, yes, it was a rather nice place to be. We were packed off to this other boarding school. That was a boarding school as well, by the way. We were packed off to this boarding school in the northwest of London.
By the name of?
Mill Hill School. So actually, it was not too far away from Harrow. We could see Harrow across the valley.
Were these formative experiences what led you to your belief in something other than traditional structured education?
Indirectly. I take it you mean, why did I become interested in Waldorf schools?
Quite.
Right. Well, it so happened that while I was at school, Mill Hill School, I thought foreign languages were pretty boring, because, I mean, the teachers that we had were just useless. And I could already speak German, for one thing. I mean, I couldn't really speak it, but if you speak Dutch, German isn't far away. Anything we did in German, I could pick up immediately and figure out and knew exactly what it was. So I gave up languages, actually, and after O-level, I did physics, chemistry and maths.
Jolly good decision.
Yes, that was really interesting stuff, and we actually built a computer which could add up, multiply, divide and subtract up to the number 10,000. We soldered that whole thing together, just four of us. That was already 1963-64. So I was already introduced to the world of computers that we're all now used to.
To say nothing of your electronics ability.
And yes, my electronics ability there went so far as that I actually started swatting to pass my electronics exam, which would allow me to have my private radio station. I never managed, though, because you have to know a hell of a lot of theory. But I spent a year at least working for it. So we passed A-level electronics part of the physics exam without any problem at all.
And what would it have been? What sort of radio station?
Well, basically just an amateur station. You put a mast in the back of your garden, and then you're able to communicate with people all over the world, which in those days was pretty difficult.
Okay, so you're talking about ham radio.
Ham radio,
as
exactly.
Opposed to actually a transmitting to
yes.
The broadcasting to the public.
Sorry,
it's narrow casting to... Yeah, okay, fine.
Exactly. I was also able to do Morse. I remember in the cadet force, I had to teach other kids Morse. You know, you just use the key and you give them messages like that, and they had to write them. I was able to do that.
Much past SOS, I'm probably
A bit out of that. Everything. We could communicate. I could do anything in Morse, yeah.
Brilliant.
And at the right speed as well.
More music, sir.
All right. Shall we go to the deep blue?
Why? You like whales?
But at that time, I hadn't actually ever seen one, but I have later. I was moved to tears when I saw a whale right next to our boat.
Tell me where you were and what sort of boat you were in.
So it was a tiny boat which couldn't hold more than 20 people, and we were all wearing these plastic rain coats, masks, and we had to sail out from the north coast of Iceland.
Right.
And then we saw them spouting, and there were a few there. And then one came right up, and it sort of wallowed onto its back and sort of smiled. They have a sort of smile, and this... You know, to see a living being that big, which is absolutely incredible.
Mm.
Yes, I was surprised how emotionally impressed I was.
Yeah.
It's like seeing the essence of creation in a huge animal right before your eyes.
Let us talk about your views of education in general. The vast majority of people accept what the government provides, and they look for their children to pass exams and to eventually here get their matriculation, as it was in England, and eventually move into a university to get a degree. They see all of that as a necessary thing. Mm-hmm. What's your view of that?
So I went to a Waldorf school in Germany, and there I went to the top class. I went to university in Holland. When I was in this German Waldorf school, they were all coming to me, can I help them with their essay? Can I explain how the passive works in English and all that? And that got me quite interested, actually, in the job of teaching English.
Okay.
So what I had to do was to get a teacher qualification. The only way to do that is to go to university.
Mm-hmm.
So I spent 4 years at university and got an MA in Utrecht in Holland. And,
which means you did that in Dutch?
The only bit that was in Dutch I didn't need to do. But what I did need to do was, having passed A-level physics, chemistry and maths, I had to do an exam in French and in German and Latin.
And Latin?
That was the only way of getting into university, basically. They allowed me to actually start the university and do the exams afterwards.
But your view as to what you advise people to do with their children today?
Yes, of course, that was the question.
Which was the question?
What I set out to say was that I never, ever had to show my university degree papers anywhere, partly because I went into Waldorf school and they didn't want them. So I never actually needed the qualifications that I had. That has influenced my view. I would definitely say we're on the wrong track if we think that the only way to get a good job and the only way to go in for a career is through university. In Switzerland, actually, and they have actually gone away from that. And they have started restricting the number of people who can actually do A-levels to about 20%. And all the rest, they have a very good accommodation in a sort of apprenticeship system, which in most countries in Europe has disappeared completely. But in Switzerland, it's a really, really well-established thing. And having passed an apprenticeship, like woodwork or maybe...
Engineering of some sort.
Engineering or accountancy.
Yeah.
There is also a second way
to getting to university by doing a professional matura, and that allows you to go to university. So there are people who go through the professional training and then afterwards start university maybe 5-6 years later.
But isn't there also, though, a point that most jobs that the vast majority of people will do not require that level of formal education anyway?
I think so. I think you're right.
Now, obviously, I don't want to persuade somebody to exclude their children from any possibility in the future. But, you know, children can show an interest in what they want to do by the age of 16 or 17 or 18. Well, I won't say they're wasting their time, because no education is a waste of time, but it doesn't build fully broad-minded people, necessarily.
No. Especially the English system, where you only do physics, chemistry and maths,
yes,
for instance. I mean, most European countries have 9 subjects which you have to do for university entrance, right? So that would be a much more broad-minded education. But I don't think they should actually have to go to university. I think the other educational path sort of thing should be equivalent and also, you know, paid equally well. What I also find interesting, actually, if you get a combination of subjects, which is very rare, like, for instance, you could do law and biology, you get very interesting jobs if you've got a sort of combination like that, because very few people are qualified for both of those things. If I see that children do actually have this possibility, that's what I advise my kids to go in for.
Yeah. And they should always include art, I think, in education.
Yes, of course.
To a reasonable degree.
Yeah, that would be really something. The way you do things, the way you go about problems, is influenced by your exposure to art. Mm. That's definitely so.
And it's a great confidence-building exercise.
That's right. Yes, the way they feel afterwards as people, and the way they can, you know, they've found their own feet, sort of thing. That's true.
Yeah.
Yes.
More music.
That was a really memorable experience, the exposure to the Beatles. The rise of the Beatles as well. I mean, I don't think the Beatles existed or were very well known before I was in upper school. Actually, I must say, I already thought that the Beatles were much better than all the others at that time. I was really impressed also by the personalities of Ringo Starr, with his big nose and drumming thing. And then I liked Paul McCartney. I thought John Lennon, you know, cool guy. And George Harrison is the one I knew least, I think, of the four.
The sound of the Fab Four.
Yes.
John, Paul, George and Ringo, Can't Buy Me Love. 2 bits of music left. The guest in the programme today, Alec Templeton. Let us just say what you feel about the future of education in general. You are here working with Waldorf. How do parents make decisions? How should children approach education themselves? So many people are talking about other schooling types, not only Waldorf, there's Montessori schools and lots of other options. And as we've said, a resurgence of an apprenticeship idea would be logical and practical, vocational kinds of education.
Mm-hmm.
What would you say to governments who don't want thinking people, it seems? They want people that are easy to mould and do what they're told, rather than highly intelligent, almost, it seems. That's how education looks to me, anyway.
Yes.
Like we've narrowed the mind of the thinking man.
Mm. The other day, I met people that I have known for a long time. The younger sister was actually our godchild. And she's just come back to Europe from South Africa. And they lived on a farm miles away from anywhere. There were 4 or 5 kids from 2 or 3 families who did homeschooling. And I never realized how much schooling they actually did. I now know that 2 of those 5 kids have passed their matura in Germany. The other 3 are still in school, and they're not having any kind of problem. And they only had 2 hours of homeschooling for 8 years.
2 hours a day.
Yeah. I mean, that is amazing. And it really shocked me, because I think, well, what do we actually do? What do we spend all these hours a week? What do we actually achieve by that? And I think that is the future of education. That question will be influenced by that, because more and more schools are producing a certain kind of citizen, basically. And it's not geared to the needs of a child. It's not geared to their future. It's not geared to anything except economics, basically.
Mm. If you do homeschooling, you're totally committed to making your children into intelligent, thinking, broad-minded human beings.
That's right.
So that's why it's effective. Even if it is only 2 hours, it's effective because the intensity with which you do it. But of course, if you do homeschooling, you're probably actually doing schooling all the time. Because of your attitude and the way you're talking and allowing your children to think and do.
But might that not answer the question, what is the future of schools?
Yeah.
Because then that would mean that schools would have to reduce the number of hours sitting in a classroom and go out and into nature, climbing mountains, finding out about a lot of things that you were heard about theoretically in the old days, and then now you will go and discover for yourself.
Mm. But what we're doing, of course, is saying in this conversation that we put a big pressure on people who have families because they're going to be responsible for ensuring the education of their children.
Yes, that's true. But I think governments would have to go into the direction of enabling various kinds of educational theory to be realized and giving the parents a really free choice as to what kind of schooling they want their children to have. I mean, it shouldn't be a state school which costs nothing and all the others, you know, would cost. I mean, that would definitely have to end.
That is a problem, isn't it? It's a problem in the UK, for example. Not so much here in Slovenia, where the Ministry of Education seems to have, maybe partly through Istok Kordic in the school in Ljubljana and his brilliant connection with the system here. But there is either 100% or at least significant funding in all of the three current and will be four schools here in Slovenia. That's not true in the UK.
No, that's right.
You pay your education taxes and you pay for your education.
You're paying double.
Separately.
In Switzerland, there's no school that gets any kind of funding from anywhere. No Waldorf school in Switzerland gets public funding.
Okay. So, unfortunately, it means that Waldorf is doing the exact opposite of what Rudolf Steiner wanted. It's being elitist.
Exactly, that forces it to be to only accept parents who could pay for it, and that makes them elitist. But it's not the same in all countries. I mean, in Holland, for instance, there the state school teachers don't get any more pay than the Waldorf school teachers, and the government actually pays the wages and a lot of the maintenance of the school buildings as well.
Mm.
So the funding is equally divided there. Mm. And the result of that is that there are an enormous number of Waldorf schools.
I guess what we are both saying, though, is that parents have to work and think very hard about what they want to do for their children.
Well, yes, I think so. That's right.
And not just simply follow the sheep like whatever is provided.
No.
If they want the best for their children.
Well, I mean, the point is that a lot of parents don't really know what state school is. The mainstream schools, they can only decide on by what they experience themselves as pupils. And often they had bad experiences, so that's why they're looking for alternative education and send them to schools where they don't really know much about the school itself either.
But don't you think, I don't know about Slovenia in particular, but don't you think, I know in England, a significant number of parents just send their children to school?
That's
they don't actually think about what that means. It's not part of their game plan.
Exactly. That's probably true. Yeah.
More music.
Kunst der Fuge.
A piece of Bach.
Yes. That is a remarkable piece of work. It's sort of 12 sections, and that is for the same instruments, two violins, viola and cello. When you play that maybe the 10th or 20th time, you begin to realize the genius of Bach. I didn't realize that he was that good. I didn't, really. But playing it, it's like a mathematical problem. You don't see the connections between the four instruments to begin with. But then when you start playing, you suddenly start hearing how the other fits in with what you are playing. And that is what happens after the 21st time.
The jigsaw puzzle of music.
It's a jigsaw puzzle. It's fantastic.
How much longer are you going to teach teachers?
I don't know. I think as long as people keep inviting me and as long as I feel I like doing it. I retired 7 years ago. I started.
But you didn't. Here you are, still working.
That's it. I didn't. No, exactly. Well, I started retiring 7 years ago, and the teacher's training work I've been doing for over 30 years because I always did it on the side, also in countries like Hungary and Baltics and Norway especially. And it was interesting when I worked in Switzerland, and they gave me a paid leave because I wasn't getting any wages in countries like Latvia or Estonia because they didn't have the money. So I got paid leave, and in that way, the Swiss state was actually
effectively funding another country's
Waldorf schools.
Yeah,
they're very generous.
The actual act of teaching is very rewarding, isn't it?
It is, definitely. I always enjoyed it, right to the last day.
Mm. But surely the act of teaching teaches to teach. Because you
That is a different thing, but that is also very rewarding. But sometimes I have to still teach pupils.
Right.
So when I was in Latvia last time, the German teacher that I was supposed to be working with was ill, and then the rector just said, could you take that class? And I said, well, on the condition that you go come in with me and introduce me.
Okay.
And then I did. Nice. When he left the room, they said, we can't speak any German, and we don't want to. And I said, oh, come on, let's start, you know, and started counting. And well, they were very, very consistent. And they said, when it got to three, they said, no idea what that is. So that's how it started. But by the end of the lesson, you know, we were saying sentences like, my crazy monkey is drinking milk. And everybody had to write down everybody else's sentence. And the amazing thing was they could remember what everybody else said.
If you energise children, their ability to memorise stuff is remarkable.
Yes.
But you have to energise them.
Well, that's right.
You have to make it fun and exciting.
That's right, yes.
And we've obviously been talking for nearly an hour because I hear the chimes of the clock again. Music, I got the impression, apart from your love of playing and your love of listening to certain kinds of music, music isn't the most important thing in your life, I'm guessing,
yes.
From all of that.
Yes.
But presumably live music is. That's what really works for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you like? What have you particularly enjoyed as a performance, seeing live, which will become our last piece of music for the show?
Well, I must say that opera has something really special in that it is a combination of seeing action on the stage, getting the atmosphere of the scenery, and at the same time, it's the music. And how that fits together is wonderful in the case of La Traviata.
Alec Templeton, may you have a very long and successful continuing career in energising others to teach our children.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being in the show.
It was a pleasure.